This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Orthodox Radio Crusade, sort of, since neither Bill Weinberg nor Anne-Marie Hendrickson are here. Music from Persia. I'm Ken Gale. I'll be substituting for Bill and Anne-Marie as best I can. When Max asked me if I'd be able to sit in, I sort of thought about this show and I realized, well, what Morse Orthodox Radio Crusade is to me is interesting people talking about interesting things with other interesting people. So I immediately emailed Alexei Kondratiev, who's one of the most interesting people that I know, and asked him if he could come on, and he could. And I asked him to bring international music, because Bill Weinberg plays a lot of international music, and I brought some of my own. And that first piece was Persian. Alexei, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, these are two players of the sitar, which is a different instrument from the sitar in India. It's a much simpler instrument. It's a lute with a long neck, which has four strings, even though the name means three strings.
No.
Yes, it does. And this is a father and son who are traditional musicians who are guardians of them. And the tune is a Bakhtiari tune. That is a tune that's associated with the Bakhtiar people in a region of Iran.
Now, Alexei here speaks over 60 languages. He has a very strict definition of fluency, so he says he's only fluent in 13 of them. Is Persian one of your languages?
Yeah, but it's not. I'm not really fluent. I mean, I can read it, I know it, and basically, it was a language that my grandfather preferred to speak. So I have it as a kind of family language.
Your grandfather?
Yes,
your Russian grandfather.
Yes, my grandparents lived in Iran. They lived in Persia. It was still called Persia at that time internationally. And he was actually a general in the Persian army. He trained a Cossack corps for the Persian army. And then eventually the British, who were still playing the great game, you know, with Russia in Asia, essentially forced him and other Russians out of Iran. And so they went to India after that and eventually back to Europe.
So now your family is from France.
My mother's family,
your
yes.
Your mother's family. Mm-hmm. But then isn't that where your father ended up?
Yes, that's right. That's where a lot of emigres from Russia ended up, of course.
Of course? Why of course?
Well, because they had, you know, long-standing ties with France and with French culture. A lot of educated people in Russia learned French as a matter of course, as a kind of international language. And so there were lots of contacts for Russians in France.
Huh?
And so when my grandparents left Asia, they first went to Italy, but then eventually they wound up, like most Russian emigres, in Paris.
And but your mother is French.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I know she retired from working at the UN, where she did translating in all these languages. Like, oh, it runs in the family.
Well, she actually was in the UN since it was founded. She originally came from Europe to work in the UN.
Oh.
At when it was still at Lake Success.
My goodness, I didn't know this about you. So she worked it since the very beginning.
Yep. Mm-hmm. She was the first generation of people to come over from Europe as staff.
And she did simultaneous translation in five
That
different
was
languages?
Later. She was she did secretarial work originally, you know, filing and stuff like that. But then she trained to become a simultaneous interpreter, and that's what she did for most of her time at the UN.
Now, I spent a day at the UN a couple years ago and came out of it with a much worse opinion of what I had for it when I went in, because it seemed to be totally run by money. They had an eco-fair, and the eco-fair had OPEC, and they had a pro-nuclear energy group. The closest thing to anything environmental was Barbados tourism. It was just dread. And I'm walking around, and I asked everybody, since I had this behind the scenes, you know, pass that somebody got me. So I started asking people, what does the UN do? And everybody kept telling me what it might be able to do, or what it could do, or what it should do, or what they hope it'll be able to do someday. And nobody had anything good to say about what it did do. Well, you have to remember, it's an intergovernmental, not an international agency, so of course governments control it.
Exactly. That's the problem with the UN, is that it can essentially advise governments on what they ought to do, but it has no way of coercing governments to do the right thing. So if it's not in the interest of a particular government, they're not going to make money out of something, then, you know, they can simply disregard most of the UN's advice.
Which they do.
Which they do, yes.
I mean, you had this, you know, incredibly, supposedly well-respected intergovernmental panel on climate change, and yet governments are ignoring it. Their own scientists contribute to it, and they ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of the expediency of another dollar tomorrow versus the destruction of the climate of their own country in the future.
Well, there's always the assumption that it's going to happen in a long time, and we'll all be dead by the time it reaches crisis proportions.
Don't these people have kids?
Well, I guess that's not enough of an argument for them.
Isn't it enough of an argument for the kids?
Well, the kids, when they grow up, may have to may take other measures, but as it is right now, I think they just have too much, you know, interest in the system as it is, the status quo.
You know, except for one event that the East Side Democratic Party ran, every large environmental event that I've gone to has been mostly young people. So clearly older people have divorced themselves to what's going on, and the younger people who didn't live through the changes – I mean, the people who are old enough to remember when there were less hurricanes and when there weren't as many severe hurricanes.
I don't think people remember that very well.
I guess not.
I think it's more a problem. I think I saw that even, you know, when during the Reagan years, when environmental problems started getting more discussed more. But you could see that people of Reagan's generation simply did not connect. And I think it's simply that it's a new problem. It's before that, I mean, there were huge environmental changes caused by humans, but it didn't really affect human health and human lives in the same kind of burning, urgent way that it has come to. And it's taking a long time for people to adjust to that, to realize that something is happening and that it can't be business as usual anymore. And I think it's very much age-related. Yes, I think people who are from older generations who are never brought up on this kind of problem, We never really had to think about it seriously,
yeah.
Are less inclined to.
They've been measuring the sea level at the Battery for 100 years, and there's an extra foot of sea level. So we know that there's sea level rise, but again, it's like,
it's so slow.
Some scientists said that the sea level's a foot higher, oh, big deal. You know, when I take the subway, it's not flooded, so I don't care.
Exactly. Right.
The fact that it floods more often than it used to.
Yes. What is a foot? You know, that same way of thinking. You know, well, maybe by the time it's like 10 feet, you know, it'll be a crisis, but I won't be around then, so who cares?
I wonder, you know, I mean, supposedly everybody cares about their kids. And certainly politicians can manipulate the public into doing a lot of terrible things by going, it's for the children, it's for the children, even if what it actually does is damage, you know, generations to come.
Yeah, I think that people tend to see their children's future in different terms. That is, they're thinking mostly of the economic future of their children. They're not thinking about burning health issues of that kind, you know, especially when it's huge problems. Global problems that they feel they don't have that much control over.
Yeah,
so they'd rather deal with it through denial than any other way.
Yeah, I spoke to a woman from England who was an energy expert going to a building energy conference, and she was amazed to find out that in England they use half the amount of energy per person as Americans do. And she's like, the lifestyle's the same. Why do I use half the amount of power? Mm-hmm. And then people in the audience started throwing out suggestions of smaller commutes to work and smaller homes.
Mm-hmm.
I yelled at awnings.
Yeah, the lifestyle is actually quite different.
Wow.
That's what people don't realize.
You've lived in both places.
Yes, well, but what you're just starting to say, you know, smaller homes, smaller commutes, a sense of community and of doing things locally. So that you don't have to bring things over enormous distances.
Well, I mean, they have a high street. We have a main street, and every town has a main street.
Yeah, but I mean, this is disappearing in America. It's still very strong in most of Europe. It's also disappearing in Europe, largely through the imitation of American models. But it hasn't changed as much in Europe.
Yeah,
as
I hear you talk
here.
About imitation of American models in a lot of different ways,
mm-hmm.
like standards of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Which are different, you know, throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
And people throughout the world are adopting American standards of beauty, even if it's unhealthy for where
exactly.
they live.
Right.
Give us an example.
Well, a very good example is in the Pacific, you know, where in Polynesia.
Which is one of your languages.
Yes, well, in Tonga and in Fiji and Samoa, places like that. People tend to be rather large, and they're not necessarily unhealthy.
Why are they so large?
It's genetics and probably diet to some extent, but mostly genetics. And they tend to become large. And it doesn't usually lead to health crises.
In other words, they live long lives comfortable lives.
Right.
And,
And they consider that appearance to be normal, you know. And again, it's American media that are starting to get, especially young women, to be horrified at the way they look. And to become anorexic and try to starve themselves. And simply from the way they're built, they're never going to look like supermodels.
Hmm.
So it leads to, you know, severe mental problems and severe, you know, physical health problems as they desperately try to change their appearance.
So what has that done to the society?
Well, I don't think it's done very much to the whole society as yet, but it's starting to dislocate it, you know, the values that are traditional to society are not being passed down because of the interference from American-produced media, which now dominate the entire world.
Oh, so the Polynesians are a lot less Polynesian than they used to be.
Yes, they become less and less Polynesian as, you know, they no longer reprocess their culture in their own communities, you know, through their interactions. They swallow, they consume much more of a foreign culture. And so their culture, the interference starts to dislocate their own cultural traditions. This is happening, you know, everywhere in the world.
I remember reading a feminist writer who talked about standards of thinness in the world and said, you're not fat, you just live in the wrong country.
Mm-hmm.
But now, of course, the whole, somebody told me that there are certain parts of Africa where the standard of beauty is exactly 13 rolls of fat. when you bend over.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Was that you who told me that?
I don't think so.
And it's
actually in India there was a standard of beauty like that where, you know, you have to have a certain number of rolls of fat to be attractive.
So the homogenized nature of American culture, mm-hmm. You know, I guess cultural imperialism, to mm-hmm. use a nice WBAI catchphrase.
Yes, it is cultural imperialism, of course. And I think it's to the point that when we discuss the free market, people who push the free market here want all cultural property to be on the free market, which means essentially that small countries, small ethnic groups, aren't allowed to maintain their own cultures. They're not allowed to defend their own cultures because they have to be on the free market to compete with American media.
Well, and I don't know, hundreds of languages that have gone extinct in the last 10 or 20 years.
Yes, and it's continuing, of course, and people don't realize that whenever a language disappears, it's a whole tradition of human experience that disappears. Languages are not interchangeable.
But also knowledge. I interviewed one person who's trying to at least tape record as many different North Asian languages mm-hmm. as she can.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that the people who live in North Asia, you know, Siberia mm-hmm. and areas around there, they know things about their local environment because
yes.
that's where they live. And the language reflects that knowledge.
Yes.
And when they don't have that language, the knowledge of the local environment goes with it.
Yes, exactly. And that's what's very important now is that the ecological movement is starting to realize that cultural diversity goes with biodiversity. That when you destroy cultural diversity, you're also destroying biodiversity.
Well, the Center for Biodiversity and mm-hmm. Conservation, they have a conference every spring.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years ago, that was exactly what their conference mm-hmm. was on cultural biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. Well, cultural diversity, in the sense it's,
yeah.
you know, the same race, same people, same species, but living in very different ways and thinking in very different ways. And what I'm usually most fascinated by in terms of learning languages and such is languages that are spoken not by huge groups of people with a great deal of political clout, but small people that have been attached to one plot of ground for generations.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that habitat intimately, and their language reflects that. It's entirely adapting them to live in that precise spot.
But the environment is changing.
Well, now it is, yes.
Yeah.
So, and of course, the cultural environment is changing too, because you have new media that is destroying these particular cultures, preventing them from being transmitted.
And then there's a legal aspect to a local group of people tied to a plot of land where they know the land.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to somebody who works with Native Americans from Oregon to Alaska and into mm-hmm. Canada and that whole area, and how there's a treaty where this group of Native Americans is in this part of
mm-hmm.
Canada,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. This is where you mm-hmm. you are to live forever, and they know the area. And at one point, one of the groups, you know, they have, of course, religious secrets, and the religious secrets are tied to the land.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a particular plant that had medicinal properties. It only grew in this one area of Canada. And they felt that they would bequeath this to the world and tell people about mm-hmm. the medicinal properties of these berries.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is they tell a scientist who publishes it, and then a bunch of pharmaceutical companies come along and they go, oh, medicinal quality? And they took mm-hmm. every single solitary berry.
Mm-hmm.
These plants are now extinct. Because they can't grow, they every berry was gone,
mm-hmm.
and the entire next generation of this plant was gone, and so there's a large American tribal council where they go, don't give your secrets away mm-hmm. ever again. They'll publish it, then everybody can have it, and they'll destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not preserving it by telling people;
mm-hmm.
you're actually helping to destroy it,
mm-hmm.
and I think they were taking the book, you know, like a lot of the secrets from Tibet. they're giving them out so, mm-hmm. because they're afraid that the Chinese that have invaded Tibet will destroy their culture. So mm-hmm. the only way to preserve it is to share it,
mm-hmm.
which seems to be working for Tibet, but it did not work for the Native Americans.
Well, because it's a different kind of thing, you know. I mean, a medicinal property is something that you can put on the market much more easily than, say, a form of spirituality, which requires a lot more commitment and personal interaction and so forth. It's much more subjective. Now, there's an anthropologist named Gary Nabhan who works in Arizona particularly, and he wrote a book about the Tohono O'odham, the people that used to be called the Papagos, and who live near Tucson and in the Sonoran Desert. And he writes about their culture and how it adapts them to living in the Sonoran Desert and how they perceive the Sonoran Desert in a way completely different from Americans. You know, to them it's not a desert. It's a place full of life. It's a place full of light and life. And he shows how their culture is changing and is gradually becoming disconnected from the adaptation to living in a desert environment in two different ways. One is, of course, assimilation into Anglo-American culture, through the media and such. And the other is more subtle, is through becoming media Native Americans. It is New Age Native Americans, Native American culture as it's presented in the media as a consumer item.
Wow.
So, they start thinking, well, I'm a Native American. I'm one of those people, with Mother Earth and Father Sky and whatever. And they have this simplified version that is totally different from their real traditional culture. But that is
so they become
seen as
generic
a,
Indians instead yes. of people of Arizona.
Exactly, right. And the generic Indian thing, of course, is another consumer item that is created essentially by white society. It's a way of exploiting what's there.
Since we talked about what's going on in Africa and Polynesia, I guess it's the same thing. It's going on in America as well.
Yeah, in different ways, of course, because there are different things that can be marketed in all of those different venues.
And it's I guess I was about to say it's almost scary, but no,
it is scary.
It absolutely is scary because the diversity of humanity is mm-hmm. kind of interesting.
But it's more than kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's like biodiversity. It's what you need to survive. You can't put all your eggs in one basket. You can't have just one culture that sees things in only one particular way. You have to have that variety so that there are options. That, one group of people is doing things wrong, they're not surviving properly, but there are other ideas that can be shared from another perspective. And once you get rid of all of those other perspectives, then you have no hope left. You're sort of like the lemmings going over the cliff, you don't see anything to the sides. You don't see any other route that you could take.
Yeah, I just realized there was part of the story about Native Americans being tied to a particular mm-hmm. part of land. As the climate changes, mm-hmm. Their knowledge of what grows there is gone because it doesn't grow there anymore. Mm-hmm. It grows north. Mm-hmm. But see, up north, there's another group of people who are legally tied mm-hmm. to that part of the land.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of being able to follow the plants and animals that they know, they're mm-hmm. stuck where they're at with the plants and animals moving mm-hmm. and them changing with it. And, of course, they don't move together.
Mm-hmm.
This part, this plant in the ecosystem moves, and then this one does, and then this one does. So it's a complete...
Yes, but, of course, if you actually interact with the land in a living way, you note these changes. I mean, these changes have been happening for a long time. And so you change together with the land. That's how you adapt to it.
So they have to talk to the people who already know about these plants.
Yes. And they have to, they just see them arriving. They see them growing. And they get to know them because they're there, because they're tied to the place as they are. I think that's one of the main problems in, especially in American culture, in dominant American culture, and that is causing a lot of a misunderstanding of environmental problems, is the fact that Americans aren't rooted for the most part. They move all the time. You get a job in some other state and you move there, and then maybe you spend a few years in that state, and then you'll move to a completely different part of the country, and you'll have some, plastic suburb that you move to with the houses that look exactly the same as where you moved from. you know, the same lawns and stuff, artificial environments around them, and you don't get attached to it.
Well, even the same food.
Yeah, you don't get attached to it. None of the things are really local. So you don't learn to see the land, actually, and what's there normally. And by not seeing that and by not caring, that's how you don't understand even what environmental problems are.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and this is Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. I am Ken Gale, sitting in for Bill Weinberg and Anne-Marie Hendrickson. Bill Weinberg is out of town. Anne-Marie is feeling under the weather, so I'm trying to do as best I can. And luckily, I have Alexei Kondratyev here, who is a linguistic anthropologist, a degree from Columbia University, and he's a science fiction writer, and he's a comic book writer, and he teaches Irish and Celtic mythology at the Irish Arts Center. And what am I leaving out?
That's plenty.
There's an awful lot to Alexei. And one of the things that some people might think, you know, you must be the only one in the world, of course you're not, is that you consider yourself both a pagan and a Christian at the same time.
That's true.
And I think most people who are one or the other feel that, no, they're supposed to hate the other.
Yeah, that's
you can't
common.
Be both.
Yeah, it's becoming less so. You know, it used to be that way. I think it's less it's gradually evolving in other directions. I think the future of religious convictions in our society, in our culture, is more that seeing a lot of spiritual paths is compatible and is offering different things. You know, it's like speaking different languages in a way.
Well,
it gives you different perspectives.
Yeah, but that's religious tolerance.
It's not religious tolerance.
It's being one and tolerating another. Okay, your path is worthy too.
No. It's that you can actually follow these different paths yourself.
At the same time.
At the same
which
time.
Which you're doing. And,
yes.
And certainly we both know a lot of people who are doing both.
Yes.
But how do you explain that to somebody who just can't understand how you're brought up to hate?
Yes, I think it's mostly that people misunderstand the other path. You know, they tend to limit it in ways that it's not limited. That is, a lot of people who are anti-Christian tend to see Christianity through its institutions, you know, through churches that are intolerant themselves, and that tend to deny a great deal about human life that is affirming, you know, that is life-affirming, a lot of, you know, the problems with the body, with sexuality, with things like that, you tend to caricature Christians as being uptight about that and not knowing how to deal with it, except through denial and repression. And that's not necessarily the case at all. That doesn't have to be the case. You know, that's a superficial look at what Christian tradition is about. Similarly, people tend to think that paganism is the denial of Christianity simply. You know, it's about blood sacrifice bizarre practices that are seen as primitive or backward or generally unacceptable to a modern way of looking at things.
But.
And again, that's not necessary. But I think paganism as it exists now is a nature religion. That is, it's about realizing that you are here in this body now, living in this world, in this environment, and you have to be in balance with it. You have to affirm the life that's there, that's given to you.
You know, that sounds like every pagan is or should be a political activist.
Yeah, and I think a lot of them are. I mean, there's certainly a strand of paganism that is very strongly politically active, and that is very conscious of environmental problems and that something has to be done about them, and that do organize for that. Certainly, you know, the whole reclaiming movement that Starhawk started has played a big role with that, especially out west.
Yeah, well, Starhawk has done a lot of things combining religion and political activism,
yes.
Whether
mm-hmm.
it's
she's made a career of that.
Whether it's peace or, yeah. or environmental issues,
mm-hmm.
Which she connects as I think most sophisticated activists would.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, well, I think that reminds me of a song.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a song that, to me, is a multi-religious song. In this case, it's both Christian and Jew. But this is You Blumenfeld. It's a song that the 24/7 BAI listeners have heard me play every December for years, ever since I first learned of it.
Jesus was a homeless lad with an unwed mother and an absent dad. And I really don't think he would have gotten that far if Newt, Pat, and Jesse had followed that star. So let's all sing out praises to that long-haired radical socialist Jew. Oh, when Jesus taught the people he would never charge a tuition fee. He just took some fishes and some bread and served up free school lunches instead. So let's all sing out praises to that long-haired radical socialist Jew. Oh, he healed the blind and made them see. He brought the lame to their feet. Yeah, rich and poor, anytime, anywhere. Just pioneering that free health care. So let's all sing out praises to that long-haired radical socialist Jew. Well, now Jesus hung with the low-life crowd. But those working stiffs sure did him proud. Yeah, some were murderers, thieves, and whores. But at least they didn't do it as legislators. So let's all sing out praises to that long-haired radical socialist Jew. Well, now Jesus lived in troubled times. The religious right was on the rise. Oh, now what could have saved him from his terrible fate? Separation of church and state. So let's all sing out praises to that long-haired radical socialist Jew. Sometimes I fall into deep despair when I hear all those hypocrites on the air. Oh, but every Sunday gives me hope when pastor, deacon, priest, and pope are all singing out their praises to some long-haired radical socialist Jew. They're all singing out their praises to.
My sentiments exactly.
Yeah, speaking of religion and politics getting all mixed together, I think that song says it well.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, I mean, what Hugh Blumenfeld is obviously saying is that, you know, Jesus was a political figure.
Well, yes.
Involved in the political
issues of
today.
He wouldn't have gotten killed otherwise.
Dealing with the political issues of today,
yes.
2,000
yes.
years ago, it's mm-hmm. like nothing ever changes.
No.
I'm surprised I've never played that for you, for somehow it skipped through. I guess because we don't talk music. And the person I'm talking to is Alexei Kondratiev, who speaks over 60 languages, but he says it only 13 fluently. Different people have different definitions of fluency. What's yours?
Oh, fluency meaning that I can carry on a conversation without really hunting for words, you know, and idiomatic use of language. Because there's, you know, any number of languages that I can describe accurately and like, that I can use, that I can teach somebody else the basics of. But that doesn't mean that I'm really fluent in the sense of, you know, just using it without thinking.
Now, do you? I remember at one point you considered Polynesian something you're fluent in.
Well, Polynesian is a family of languages, yeah. So there are a number of Polynesian languages that I know. Not all of them, but I know certainly Hawaiian, Maori, Samoan, Tongan, Tahitian, and a few others.
And I suppose every one of those languages must be endangered because the islands that the people are from are literally getting flooded with sea level rise.
Some of them are, yes. Well, the nation of Tuvalu, for instance,
yeah.
is scheduled essentially to disappear beneath the seas sometime this century. And there are plans to relocate all the people somewhere in another place in the Pacific.
Well, I understand that New Zealand is one of the places that a lot of the people from Tuvalu are going.
Supposed to go, yes.
And I talked to somebody from New Zealand about 10 years ago when I first learned that this was happening, and I said, so is there any, like, you know, strife mm-hmm. between the people moving in, the people who are already there? And he said no. And I asked people from New Zealand that, and about 2 years ago, I got a yes. That there is a little bit of Pacific Islander backlash. There's ethnic slurs for them and denial of jobs and all the cliches of the new immigrants.
Yeah. Well, in general, I think, there's New Zealand society tends to be rather racist. You know, the native Maoris are a large part of the population, but they're not to be looked down on by a lot of white New Zealanders. And there's often very negative attitudes towards Maoris who are actually politically active and well-organized. I mean, there was a person I remember who was wearing a T-shirt that he got from a conference that he went to with Maoris. The T-shirt said Rangatiratanga, which is sovereignty, you know. And white New Zealand, he was noticing these white New Zealanders were looking at him with this expression of intense hate in the airport. And he didn't know why, and he realized it was the T-shirt. Mm-hmm. And they might not have known, you know, what it even meant, but they knew that it was something Maori and it was some kind of political affirmation. And they strongly disapproved. So I suppose having other Polynesians, and again, the Maoris are not the only Polynesians who live in New Zealand. I mean, there are lots of immigrants from the Cook Islands, which are a New Zealand protectorate of some sort. And, you know, which is actually a rather large area with lots of islands and lots of different cultures. A lot of them are coming over and working in New Zealand as well. And there's that same feeling, you know, we don't want these people who are not of British stock, you know, interacting with us.
Yeah, I think when the Pacific Islanders, the non-Maoris were a minority, it was like, well, you know, it doesn't matter. But now I guess the minority is not quite so minor anymore.
Well, there aren't that many Tuvaluans, so it can't be that enormous. Proportion of the population.
Well, enough.
But wherever they're settling, yes, wherever a group of them comes and it's a large enough group, it forms a community of people who are different because they come from someplace else. So you're going to have the usual anti-immigrant kind of reaction.
And I would expect, just as with most immigrant communities worldwide, the kids mm-hmm. will want to assimilate to where they live now and won't want to learn the language of their parents until, you know, in their 30s and 40s when they're like, I should have been learning it all along. And then they're sort of learning it as a scholar, not as a person who just speaks it every day.
Yeah, it's a little different in some other countries, some other communities, because, again, it depends how structured the community is. And a lot of the Polynesian communities are very structured. They have elders, you know, who actually have authority over families and keep the community together. And that kind of authority, you know, as long as the young people feel that they're part of that structure, they tend to conform. They will learn the languages.
So the folks from Tuvalu are leaving in groups, not, you know, one family at a time?
Yeah, well, they might be leaving one family at a time, but they're going to particular places where Tuvaluans already are.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, that's kind of common of immigration.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm thinking of people I know who, you know, I don't want to learn Spanish. You know, mm-hmm. my parents spoke. I'm American. I'm not going to learn Spanish. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they're 30 and they're like, I want to learn Spanish now.
Yes.
And it's
a lot easier, of course, to find ways of learning Spanish.
But the fact that there's that denial and mm-hmm. the difficulty of learning mm-hmm. Spanish because mm-hmm. You haven't spoken it mm-hmm. your whole life, and it's not like, you know, mm-hmm.
you're getting it naturally in the family, yes. Yeah, well, that's a common attitude of immigrant children in general. I mean, I was rather unusual in that sense because, mm-hmm. you know, I grew up with my parents speaking Russian and French to me, and I naturally spoke it, and I didn't find any desire to speak only English at all, ever. But a lot of my cousins, on the French side in particular, who came here, they wound up, speaking only English, having their parents speak French to them and then answering back in English, as you often hear immigrant children. And that's a normal attitude, I think. It's unfortunate, but children tend to be attracted to centers of power, you know, mm-hmm. to... Who is the person who's got the power? Who is the person who is on top? You want to be with the person who's on uh-huh. top. You don't want to be on the bottom. So if you feel that you speak a different language from everybody else, that gives you a disadvantage in their eyes. You know, you're weird. You know, that language is some weird thing my parents speak or my family speaks. It's not what everybody speaks. It's not what's on television, which is reality. You know, this is power. This is what has authority is there. And so because my language isn't there, therefore I don't want to speak it. I don't want to be identified with it.
And television sure has power and authority. I mean, mm-hmm. people will do a lot of things they would never do in real life mm-hmm. if they can get on TV to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's plenty of people willing to exploit that to sell commercials. And it's kind of bizarre.
Yeah, but, I mean, in a larger sense, you know, it people feel that it's what binds people together and that, therefore, what's on television is what's acceptable.
Well, it is something that's everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's about the only common culture that we have.
Yes, exactly. And... a lot of Native American groups, for instance, are afraid that they're losing their culture. Even if the elders want to pass down their culture to young people, the influence of television makes it impossible. You know, they don't want to speak Hopi or Navajo or whatever, you know, when obviously if you speak English, you're much cooler and you have a lot more power mm-hmm. in society. You know, you can get around and do things which you don't if you're part of this small, restricted culture.
Well, the Mohawks at Akwesasne have a school mm-hmm. that teaches reading, writing, arithmetic mm-hmm. in the Mohawk language mm-hmm. up until eighth grade. Mm-hmm. And then they switch to English so that the kids can mm-hmm. perform in the rest of the world.
A lot of the
better.
Celtic communities do that too. You know, there's a lot of Irish medium schools and Welsh medium schools and even Breton medium schools now that do that.
In the 70s and 80s, the Akwesasne Freedom School had trouble keeping afloat, and it doesn't quite have that trouble anymore. Mm-hmm. So clearly it's something that's gotten acceptance, at least at Akwesasne.
Yes, it was a gradual process. And I think the fact that people stuck to it, you know, and saw it as something very important helped.
And they went outside Akwesasne for the money to keep the school going. Mm-hmm. I was part of the Akwesasne Freedom Coalition in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And we had a concert, you know, to put money mm-hmm. into that. And, you know, it's kind of neat. You know, I've never been to the school. The one time I tried to go there, mm-hmm. there was a blizzard and I never mm-hmm. got there. But it's nice to know that it's there. Mm-hmm. And I met Tom Porter and his kids went there and his grandchildren are going there now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just now part of life. Mm-hmm. And that didn't even exist a couple of generations ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess some communities are recapturing.
Yes, there are communities where you still have elders who are immersed in the culture. And unfortunately, a lot of Native American groups don't have that anymore. The last generation that really, you know, was completely immersed in the culture is gone. And they don't have anyone to teach anymore. You know, that's one of the things I'm interested in, is actually creating material that will allow people to learn their the languages that they lost, to create methods that enable
you to
teach.
There's a lot of movies doing that also. I mean, it used to be that if you saw a movie made by and for Native Americans, it was almost always the grandfather and the grandson. The grandson doesn't want to be Indian. He wants to be white. And the grandfather, what have I done wrong? That grandson doesn't want him. But at the end of the movie, grandson has now decided, yes, he wants to follow in grandfather's footsteps. And it was, it's like every movie seemed to be that. And now the movies are different. There's a lot more diversity. I think maybe because access to movie making is so much easier, that more different people can make their own movies. And you see a lot of different types of movies now. A lot more overtly political movies also.
Yeah. So, of Sherman Alexie's stories.
The very thing that was hurting the culture at one point is now helping the culture.
Yeah, but the point is if you have managed to gain control. See, in Wales, for instance, Welsh was losing ground to English, and the demand was for Welsh to exist in the media, to actually have Welsh on the radio, Welsh on television especially. And Winwer Evans, Welsh nationalist politician, actually went on hunger strike early on in Margaret Thatcher's tenure in order to obtain a Welsh language television station, and eventually he did. The Welsh got a television station in a language, and it made a huge difference. It didn't completely end the erosion of Welsh, simply because the, you know, Anglo media are so powerful and are so ubiquitous.
And the internet is in English.
Yeah, no, it's in Welsh too. I mean, there are Welsh listservs and things like that.
Yeah, but I mean, if you want to really
explore
the biggest part of the internet, you know, English is it.
Well, I got a new Mac last year, and it comes with Welsh and Irish on it.
Huh?
And it actually has a software for turning the language of your computer into Welsh or Irish or Cherokee or Navajo and things like that, you know.
So do you change it from language to language?
Sometimes, yeah.
It just seems like something you can do.
And Maori and Hawaiian and things like that, yes, as well.
I remember picking up a comic book script from you when you were reading a book on learning one of the Northwest Coast Indian languages, and you were thrilled about how difficult it was.
That's true.
You know, you said there were word sounds that you had never heard before in any language of the 50-some languages you knew at that point, which, I mean, I guess there must be word sounds. There must be thousands of them.
Probably not quite thousands, but hundreds, yeah, definitely.
Well, I mean, there must be 100 word sounds in English, so if you start multiplying all the languages of the world.
Not quite. There aren't really 100 in English.
Because you have all those vowels, consonants, consonant blends.
Yeah, there aren't that many, actually. I mean, there are usually combinations of other phones. No, but in Tlingit, for instance, you have sounds like... That's a hand. Or a foot, actually, I forget now. But it's... remember. Where you basically have to do a glottal stop and a velar spirant at the same time.
How can you learn that from a book?
I learned it actually from a record. You know, a book, if you know linguistic terminology, you can learn it from a book, yes.
Okay. I mean, I just remember you reading a book about how to learn that. Let's go to two different Native American pieces of music. One, Mohawk, done in a traditional style. And the other one that Alexei gave, where is she from?
She's from Arizona. She's Sharon Birch. She's a Navajo musician. And she writes her own music. She writes her own songs. She doesn't just, you know, do traditional Navajo music. So it's, I like that because it's a creative use of the culture, a continuation of the culture. You know, the not just treating it as a museum piece, but transmitting it in new forms.
I think there is a tendency for people to treat any culture that's not their own as a museum piece. And if it changes, it's like, well, wait a minute, how can I study it if it keeps changing? So we'll start out with Jerry McDonald, who is Mohawk, and then go with Sharon Birch.
Round dance.
Shinada,
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the Internet. We're live streaming this show, and it'll also be archived for, I'm not sure if they consider this an arts show or a public affairs show, since it's kind of both. But a lot of the shows are kind of both. So we just heard two pieces of music that have roots in this country. The first one was Jerry MacDonald, a CD called Peacemaker's Drum, Iroquois Social Songs. That was the Woman's Dance. And then we just heard from, tell us, Alexei.
That's Sharon Birch, who's a contemporary Navajo songwriter. And it's a song about planting corn, watching corn grow.
She just calls it Corn Song.
Right.
You know, that was really nice to play back to back, because one, of course, had no language at all, and the other one had, what language was she speaking?
Dine Pisat.
Dine, okay. you're the polyglot, not me. but we've been talking about, we've been talking about, language diversity, cultural diversity, biodiversity. Have you been following the controversies having to do with the global warming stuff from East Anglia?
Yeah.
What is your take on that?
I see it as essentially political interference. I don't think it really invalidates the science in any way.
I mean, I look upon it as, you know, well, okay, so fine. Scientists were calling people who didn't know what they knew as idiots. In what they thought was a private email. I think a lot of people call other people idiots behind their back.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is, I was like, well, don't put this data in the report. I think part of it is that I remember in high school, my college chemistry teacher telling us that water isn't really H2O. It's more like H3OOH. And we simplify it to H2O because it's easier to teach that way. And those of you going on to college will understand why H3OOH is closer, but that's not exact either. And it's the complexity of science when you're trying to explain it to a non-scientist.
Exactly. Right.
So you leave out things because you leave out things because it makes it easier to teach, because otherwise you won't be teaching anything.
Right, exactly.
And I think that's a lot of the data that was not used, because the scientists are using it among other scientists, but they're not going to have to, okay, now this is going to take me 20 minutes of explanation for some reporter whose eyes are going to glaze over, and they're not going to understand a single thing I say anyway, so just leave it out. Don't confuse them. Now, this is what the trends are. This is what everything is going on. Fox News is just having a field day saying that, you know, the global warming doesn't exist because data was, quote, falsified. And it's like saying, well, gravity, you know, oh, we falsified the mathematics of gravity, so therefore if you drop something, it won't fall.
Right.
You know, the glaciers are melting, and they haven't stopped melting just because somebody saw some East Anglian scientists insulting people. The ice caps in Greenland haven't stopped melting. They haven't added albedo because albedo is like, oh, no, there's something else to consider when we're thinking about global warming. And it's like, yeah, albedo, the actual existence of the reflective properties of the Earth itself is an aspect of climate change. Because when you melt snow, you have changed the albedo so more radiation is absorbed. And when you have more snow, such as we had because the polar ice cap melted, then you're going to increase the albedo and more of the sun's radiation will go be reflected into space. Mm-hmm. That is a complication that some reporter who doesn't know any science, I'm sure there's a lot of people whose eyes glazed over just mm-hmm. as I said that because I gave a 30-second explanation of it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, just, you know, don't start talking about albedo, too. The ice caps are melting. They're continuing to melt. You know, let's leave it at that because you can see an ice cap melting. You can't see the sun's radiation bouncing off of snow and going into space. So let's not talk about albedo. That will just confuse them. And if you talk about the currents, the oceanic, worldwide currents changing because of the depth of the ocean, because of, it's like there's so much you can give to confuse somebody. Mm-hmm. Now, some scientists, of course, are going to go, oh, give them everything. And others will go, no, you're going to do more harm than good. And that's really how I looked at it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I walked past the Fox News building, you know, mm-hmm. a couple of days ago, and they're still, that's mm-hmm. still like one of their main news stories. Mm-hmm. And usually, you know, a news story becomes a main news story for an hour, mm-hmm. and it's gone. Mm-hmm. If it's a celebrity, it'll be a main news story for a couple of days, and then it's gone. Mm-hmm. But not this one, you know, mm-hmm. they get to make fun of environmentalists. Mm-hmm. And
which is hard to do otherwise, you know. So that gives them one chance that they rarely get. That's the point.
Yeah, the one chance indeed. But, you know, they just, I guess, yeah, that's it. They can't make fun, which is their way of attacking anything, is mm-hmm. to make fun of it. So here they finally get to make fun mm-hmm. instead of ignore. Because mm-hmm. I guess it's more fun to ignore than it is to make fun than it is to ignore.
Yeah.
So now they finally, instead of just burying their heads in the sand. Mm-hmm. I asked Tom Whisker to come in 15 minutes early because there's a bit of popular culture that I talked to him about many weeks ago that I just found really fascinating. So we have Alexei Kondratiev here, who is one of the most knowledgeable Celtic scholars that anybody will ever meet. Besides speaking all the Celtic languages, including the old versions of the language, you teach them, you've written about them, and you brought some of the music from the Celtic countries. Tell us about your classes.
Classes? Well, I teach Irish at the Irish Arts Center on 51st Street.
And 11th Avenue.
That's right. And so I teach four different levels of Irish. And
four different levels?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
And
so the students continue?
That's what we're trying to do, is try to create some continuity. People, you know, going from elementary to advanced. And I now have someone, Elaine Yvrin, on, who is doing like conversational practice with people after the class, so that you know, they get to use what they learned. And it seems to be working pretty well. I mean, there is now some continuity of people who more people staying in the class right through, because there's a lot of attrition normally. People, you know, mm-hmm. start learning Irish because they say, I'm Irish, so it should be a breeze, and then they discover it's not that easy a language to learn. It's not like English at all. And so there's a lot of people get discouraged, and I think that we've had better success in the last year or so. We have people who actually stick with it more.
And what else do you teach?
I teach a class on Celtic mythology. That is, you know, the worldview of the pre-Christian Celts as you can reconstruct it from their stories, and that's going to be coming up this in January. And I also teach a class on Celtic Christianity, on the peculiarities of the early church in Ireland and in Britain.
Now, I've taken both of those last two courses, and one of the things I found interesting on the Celtic Christianity course is that you kind of included a sort of a crash course in global history, you know, knowing mm-hmm. that most Americans don't know anything about the history of Europe. So you included that as part of the course, so people had a context.
Yeah, well, you need
to
that
put
context,
these events.
Definitely,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it made the course much more interesting, because I found myself kind of brought to the world of 1,000 years ago rather mm-hmm. than just sort of a couple anecdotes. Mm-hmm. I liked the way you completed the whole worldview mm-hmm. of what was going on in the Christian church, because you know, you think of it as something hierarchical, so therefore you have one person telling everybody else what to say, do, and think.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like that at all.
Not at all, not in those days. No.
Even close. No. And sex played a big part in the fighting between bishops in the early church.
Mm-hmm.
Just go into that, since...
What do you mean? What
well, you talked about some bishops wanted to have taboos about sex built into their new religion, and other people felt that no, that's part of life, and we should.
Oh yes, it was more that there was in the Roman Empire there was during the fourth century at the time when Christianity was becoming established as the majority religion. There was a very period of great pessimism because the empire was in the process of disintegrating, and so people saw very bad times ahead, and they got very, very pessimistic. And the way they interpreted, these bad things happening was through human sin. It was because humans were so sinful that they lost all contact with God, and everything was just going to pot. And you had the Celtic viewpoint, which was represented by Pelagius, who was someone from Britain, human nature was not completely divorced from God, and that humans actually had it in them, they had the resources in them to be good. They just needed the will.
Hmm.
But they actually had the resources. They were created good, and therefore they could act out that goodness if they wanted to. Whereas the Augustinian position was more that humans are so sinful that it took a miracle for them to be good. They had to just sort of give themselves up to God and say, God, make me good because I can't do it at all. And so these are things that have been played out in the history of Christianity ever since. There are some people who resonate more with one view. And
the optimist and the pessimist.
Yes, more or less, yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me.
And the Celtic... tradition in Christianity tended to follow. Again, I don't want to say Pelagian, because when Catholic theologians use the term Pelagian or Christian theologians in general, they don't mean anything Pelagius actually taught. They mean sort of the caricature, the caricature that's been presented as the heresy, which is that you don't need God's help to do anything. You have to do it all yourself. It's all from your own efforts. And that's not at all what Pelagius taught. He just said that humans have the resource. It doesn't mean that they can't pray or ask for divine grace. It's just that they actually have the resources in them to bring out the goodness that they're supposed to express. And with that, especially with the belief that God created the world good. So it's also very positive towards nature, because you feel that the natural world is the way God meant it to be. And humans are divorced from it. So it's through contemplating the natural world that they actually come closer to God. They realize, what God wants the world to be like.
So that sounds like a further way that you reconcile that there's no conflict between both being pagan and Christian at the same time.
Yes, so that helped in that very much.
It's almost, I guess in that matter, you really look at it as one religion, not two different religions.
Well, you can say that Christianity is one you can do on paganism.
And so there's more difference between two different sorts of Christians than there are between Christians and pagans, if it's that sort of Christian.
Yes, I think so.
Which I guess would make the other sort of Christians say that other sort of Christian is wrong.
Yeah, as they have historically, yes.
It's... People have to sort of run things and be right, and in order to be right, somebody else has to be wrong, and it certainly reflects in religion, because, boy, there's going to be more passion reflected in religion than anything.
Well, because religion is about meaning. Religion is about what your life means. So people, naturally, if they don't agree on what their life means, they're going to get very passionate about it.
So when people say they get, treat football as a religion, it's because they're giving meaning to football that's greater than just a game.
Exactly.
And so that's what they say, they're being religious. Mm-hmm. Let's play some of the music you brought. What are we about to hear?
Is that the Welsh one? this is a Welsh folk group that's called the Gwerinos, which means the little commoners or the little country people. And they play, folk music. And they're in some ways a comedy group. A lot of their songs are meant to be funny. And the one I chose is not, actually. Mm-hmm. It's a rather pretty song. It's based on a traditional folk tune, but with new words. And it's like a ballad about a woman who is waiting for someone to come back to her, and he never does. And so she lives by herself in this kind of hermit situation, and she loses all her beauty. Her hair is all gone white, and she's still waiting.
Oh. All right, let's start with that. Gwerinos.
Yn nws y coed mae na ferch fach lan Yn cyrlio'i gwallt yng ngolau'r tan Mae'n cyfri'r oriau rif y gwlyth Tan ddaw ei charia, tan ddaw ei charia Diwch o fleidio hi Ac am ei gwdd mae na gadwy'n nair Ac arni lun o'r forwyn fair Mae'n cadw hon ger ei mynwes hi Tan ddaw ei charia, tan ddaw ei charia Diwch o fleidio hi Yn hafarn sian lle mae'r cwrwn dda Eisteddais lawr a chynig i echyd da Un ffrindiau o lloedd gyda mi Cyn ni'n farwelio, cyn ni'n farwelio am yng Nghymru gy Ac yno neis drwy'r ffrind hawn Wrth ferio sgwrs wrth y tân o fawr Y clywai sôn am ddrws y coed Ar ferch bach lanaf, ar ferch bach lanaf sydd yn cadw oed Brandi'r had Y tyngais lw Yn ddiamwad A throes fy ffordd Tua drws y coed At y ferfach lanaf At y ferfach lanaf Yn ddioed Ac erbyn cyrraedd Penedain I brynad o Dros chwe milltir fain Yn o'n syllu y Ar y ferch bach lanaf, ar y ferch bach lanaf, bai gwallt yn wyn. Ar gariad gŵr yr hoes ei bryd, er iddo chwalu yn llwyr ei byd, mae'n dal i ddisgwyl sŵn ei droi. Y ferch bach lanaf, y ferch bach lanaf,
Hakatia mai korua
Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Ken Gale, sitting in for Bill Weinberg, who is out of town, and Anne-Marie Hendrickson is feeling under the weather, so she's not substituting in his stead. And I'm here with Alexei Kondratiev, who speaks dozens and dozens of languages, and I asked him to bring in some international music, because of course Bill plays a lot of international music. What did we just hear?
That was a song from Easter Island. It's the singer is Tomas Tepano Tepano, who is a modern songwriter in Rapa Nui, which is Easter Island. And the song is about advice given to a pair of to parents, mother and father. And it's sort of about what we've been talking about, saying that they must pass down their culture to their children. They must, so that they can understand the power of the land and their ancestors' ways, and know the story of their ancestors, and the coming of Hutu Matua, who's the great hero, who's the first settler of Easter Island. It's a story that everybody in Easter Island normally knows. So to make sure that the children know about Hutu Matua.
What's the name of the artist?
Tomas Tepano Tepano, he's called.
And that's TOMASTEPANO, TEPANO.
That's right.
And the name of this album, which you'll pronounce it because...
It just calls Rapa Nui.
Rapa Nui, okay.
Which is the native name of Easter Island.
And the Welsh album...
It's Egwerinos. It's called Chayad Llawn, which means full moon. And it's on the Sain label, S-A-I-N, which is where a lot of native Welsh music is produced.
Uh-huh. And we've been talking about religion and politics and all kinds of stuff in this last hour. And one of the things that Anne-Marie and Bill Weinberg talk about at Morris Orthodox Radio Crusade is popular culture. And they always give a different spin on it. And some time ago, a friend of mine recommended watching McHale's Navy. And my reaction was like, McHale's Navy? And you want me to watch McHale's Navy? And he goes, yeah, check it out. So, you know, the library had it. And it's like, you know, if you don't like it, you just turn it off and give it back, right? So I watched it. And the very first episode was an origin episode. And why McHale sort of, you know, was chosen for the position he had and why he sort of had it all over Captain Binghamton. And it was written by Gene Coon. And Gene Coon is one of the movers and shakers of the original Star Trek series. So that was kind of interesting to see his name on McHale's Navy. And then I asked Tom Whisker, I mentioned, I'm watching McHale's Navy, and he started giving me all this information that all the farcical elements of McHale's Navy that I thought were a little silly were totally realistic. Okay, Tom.
I don't know if realistic is the right word. people who were there laughed their heads off at that stuff. And it's a very different period of popular culture. And there was a genre of movies and later television that fall into the heading of service comedies, where
services in the military services.
Yes. And with the Second World War being everybody did something in it. Some few people evaded the draft, you know, but pretty much, you know, millions and millions of people went through this. Jokes about bad food and basic training would get either laughter or a knowing smile from your father and your uncle watching See Here Private Hargrove rerun.
Or a knowing frown, I guess, in some cases.
Distance and time make unpleasant things sometimes funny.
Well, I remember hearing a friend's parents when he found out that she had the gall to make cream chip beef on toast.
Yes.
He did not find it funny at all that his wife was serving him non-FCC on a shingle.
They call the SOS was the and it was a it was really easy to do. The meat was 10-in-1. Allegedly, this canned.
What does 10-in-1 mean?
it's a field ration canned meat. Allegedly, it can be used 10 different ways. cans of condensed milk, and it was before the days when most soldiers carried a supply of Tabasco sauce to liven things up a little bit. And all these little details that go over the head or under the feet of younger people are, you know, it strikes something in people.
Well,
who were
you
there.
Told me that there were lots of Captain Binghamtons in
yeah,
the Navy.
Yeah, they. He would have.
And I apologize. We're talking about a 1962 to 66 or 7 TV show, but you can get it from the library or a video store. So
The last season wasn't all that good when they moved to Italy.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. You know, it's a lot of tomfoolery while waiting for things to do, but occasionally PT-73 actually did get into combat on the show.
Yeah, it did.
But
they used the same blowing up a submarine footage over and over again.
But they... the
So why were there so many Captain Binghamtons?
When they put together the PT boat program, and remember, this isn't the only small craft. You had PCs and PCEs, and the Coast Guard also. They wound up trying to get anybody who had any experience in handling yachts and cabin cruisers and stuff like that, hoping that these skills would prove useful. So you wind up with a lot of, like, yacht club commodores suddenly commissioned as direct commission as lieutenant commander. And it generally worked out pretty well. I mean, we did win the war, after all. But you had some personality types who really liked to be in charge.
Whether they had the ability or not.
The captain of USS Reluctance in Mr. Roberts is another problematic personality put by chance into a position of authority and made a lot of people very miserable. And, you know, these would be like people with some World War I Navy service and then either Merchant Marine or Yacht Club or whatever. And suddenly they desperately need people. And if they're strange people, that was a price that they would pay. And then you have the tension between these instantly commissioned people, and then you have chiefs, or worse yet. The regulars didn't like these people either. Longtime Navy chiefs who suddenly were made officers.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you'd have a 48-year-old junior grade lieutenant in command of an LST or something. And...
Well, and in McHale's Navy, they actually gave a reason that McHale got away with what he got away with, in that he was
indispensable to the admiral commanding the
because
area.
He had local knowledge, and they showed that in the first episode, that he was, you know, plying his trade, buying and selling stuff in those islands. And so when those islands became a base during the war, who knew them better than somebody who'd been doing that? And if he wanted to bend the rules a little bit, whether it's for comedic effect for TV or in real life, they had to let him bend the rules.
Sergeant Bilko did the same thing for the Army. It's
a show I don't remember seeing. I don't know if I probably never did.
It's 50s. Phil Soles.
I never saw it. I've only heard of it. I read the comic book.
But the interesting thing is that Ernest Borgnine was actually qualified to command the PT boat because as a senior chief in the Navy with 10 years service, when he decided 10 years in the Navy was enough, and he decided to try his hand at acting, and he did pretty well.
Won an Oscar.
But anyway, he commanded the converted yacht, USS Sylph, and was hunting U-boats off the U.S. East Coast in 1942.
He was hunting submarines with a yacht.
Well, a converted yacht. They painted it gray. They painted it gray, gave it four depth charges, probably two 30 caliber World War I machine guns, and hopefully a gun maybe newer than the Spanish-American War. But, yeah, there was a whole class of ships called P. The U.S. Navy has two or three-letter hull classifications. Battleship is BB. A destroyer is DE. A seaplane tender is AV, and then it would be followed by a number. USS Arizona was BB-39, for instance. PT stood for patrol. It's a patrol craft, T for torpedo, so a patrol torpedo boat. But they had all sorts of things like that, and can make you very confused. But they really had to get people to command these things. And with the desperate shortage of escort vessels, there was a class called PY, Patrol Yacht. And several of them met gruesome ends at the hands of German U-boats. I think it's the former Vanderbilt yacht ate a torpedo. She was classed as a patrol gunboat, PG, and she took a fairly small ship, took a torpedo, and I think there were just a couple of survivors out of her crew of maybe 40. But, you know, it was but most of the time, it was a lot of, you know, they spent a lot of time killing time.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.